You're listening to the Flasco Oncopod, brought to you by the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, the voice of oncology in Florida.
Hello, welcome everyone to this Flasco podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about the journey for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, the treatment sequencing, and the real-world decisions. I'm Thiago Biaki. I'm a medical oncologist, GI medical oncologist at Moffitt Cancer Center. And today, here with me, I have Dr. Raji Shamin. Raji, thank you so much. You want to introduce yourself? Thank you so much, for joining me today. And I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
Hi, my name is Raji. I'm a medical oncologist at Orlando Health Cancer Institute. I have an interest in GI oncology. I'm looking forward to our discussion as well.
Yes, I was... Actually, just to put everybody in the context here, so Flasco, ran this, survey, and it caught my attention, for this topic, actually, that the fact that most med oncs, like more than almost 90% of med oncs, would test, more than 90% of patients. So I think we all, on the same page, we all know the importance of, molecular profiling, in colorectal cancer. We have many targets. We're not lung cancer, we don't have like the same pie, the patients with lung cancer have, but we're getting there. So we're having more and more targets, every day. But I think the most critical point now is the time. So I'm curious, Raji, when you're testing this patient. So you're doing this, upfront, or you're doing this upon progression. When are you testing those patients now?
No, I think that's a great question. It's really relevant because I think timing is everything. From the time of initial diagnosis, I really think it's important to do testing, right? If you have you're going to have tumor tissue, so I proceed with NGS testing, but I also check liquid as well. Because, sometimes the tissue we have, tumor tissue is inadequate and insufficient to do an NGS testing, but at least liquids. I feel like having some information now that we have therapeutic options that are based on biomarker abnormalities, I feel testing should be done from day one, from the time of initial consultation.
I agree 200% with you. And actually, each one has like pros and cons, right? The tissue, if you have the, the alteration is more reliable, but, the turnaround time, it's long. I mean, you're going to wait like for 6-8 weeks, to have these results back. And, with the blood, sometimes we know that the accuracy sometimes is not great. So if you have a patient with, lung mets only, you might have like false negatives, et cetera. So it's more reliable in patients with liver mets, for example, but the turnaround time is 2 weeks, right? So it's the time to get a port placed. And now this is critical. And this is something that I teach, my fellows, every day. So that time that we, we started treatment with a FOLFOX bev, for everybody, send the tissue for a NGS, and then we're going to have this result to decide, what we're going to do, for second line, that time is gone. And the main reason is, first, of course, we have data for, mismatch repair deficient, patients in frontline setting with immunotherapy. But I mean, this is something that we could, catch in the immunohistochemistry too, but mainly because of breakwater data, right? So now we have data, robust, phase 3 trial with anti-BRAF immunotherapy in frontline setting combined to chemotherapy, and with, benefit in overall survival. And it's a relevant benefit. We're going to increase response rate. And most importantly, this is a disease with a poor behavior. So these patients have like a poor prognosis, and this is a very bad, biology. So you want to offer the best treatment for a patient with, a bad biology up front. So I agree 100% with you that we have to test everybody. And if you have to start with something like tomorrow, you could start with FOLFOX, right? But hold the bevacizumab. It's not the end of the world if you don't give bevacizumab for one cycle. You can start FOLFOX this week, and then once the liquid biopsy is back, like hopefully in 2 weeks, you're gonna have this information, so you can add like anti-HFR or bevacizumab or anti-BRAF therapy. I'm just curious. This algorithm is getting more and more complex. So sometimes, I got some jokes from my colleagues say, hey, now you're going to treat patients with colon cancer, in a different way, depending on location, like the right side, left side. You're going to do the same with liver cancer, but not the tumors. Well, it makes a lot of sense. Of course, the biology of those tumors are very different, but there is a big push, to use anti-EGFR in frontline setting for patients with, left-sided. Is it something that you do for all your patients, Dr. Shami, I'm just curious.
No, I think that's a very good question, and the data does show that suggests that it might improve outcomes. But I typically have a discussion with my patient. As we know, anti-EGFR therapy does come with some toxicity, rash. Rash is tolerable, but for a lot of patients to have a rash every day of their lives, we live in Florida, photosensitivity. A lot of patients actually prefer anti-VEGF therapy just for quality of life too, right? So I do present the data, I do review the options, but I think a large number of my patients for left-sided will actually pick an anti-VEGF therapy. But I do offer anti-EGFR as long as if they are RAS wild type.
Yeah, and and just to to again to keep everybody on the same page, the data that we have like for multiple studies actually is the benefit with anti-EGFR in frontline setting. This discussion is mainly in frontline setting versus bevacizumab. I agree with you. I think, to be honest, I believe in exposure more than sequence. So it was I mean it has not been proved that if the patient got like bevacizumab in frontline setting, but received anti-EGFR in the second line setting, probably this patient will have the same outcome compared to a patient having this in the frontline setting. So when they kind of compare Bev with Cetux or Bev with panitumumab, they're, I don't think this is fair, right? I mean, anti-EGFR is a line of therapy. So everybody with RAS and BRAF wild type has to receive anti-EGFR. Bevacizumab is not a line of therapy. Bevacizumab is something that helps a little bit. Anyone or everybody. So I think I don't think this is a fair comparison. And I agree with you. The main issue, I mean, I would love to treat everybody with anti-EGFR, response rate is higher, et cetera, but the main issue is the price, right? So it comes with a significant rash and or sometimes not a really bad rash, but I mean, we have to keep in mind again that this is the first line, so these patients will be on this treatment for like more than 1 year. So can you imagine, living with like a grade one or two rash like for 1 year? So because sometimes those trials are very focused on grade three and four toxicity. This is another thing that I would like to discuss with you, not only for first line, but sometimes even for later lines, like discussion, between like for fruquintinib, LONSURF, for regorafenib and later lines. So all those trials and presentations, et cetera, they're very focused on grade four toxicity or even grade three, four, grade three or higher, toxicity. But then I asked, wow, and I had this conversation multiple meetings. Can you imagine like living with a grade one or two diarrhea like for 6 months? I mean, we have to be mindful about what kind of a life expectancy, we're crazy for this patient. So if you have like six, seven episodes of diarrhea per day, you can go outside, right? So you're gonna, you have to wear, diapers. So what kind of a life expectancy would prolong? So we have to be really, really mindful about not only the intensity, but I mean, of course, with the intensity and the duration of this toxicity. So I'm saying because, sometimes with the just grade one rash, but wow, grade one rash, if you live in Florida for 1 year, this is a big deal, right?
It could be devastating, right? Quality of life. And I like how you mentioned the later line setting because I think that's even more important about quality of life because we know those patients are not going to be cured from their disease. They're going to unfortunately pass away from their cancer. It's really about tolerability, quality of life because the available agents having high risk, we don't see high response rates, but can they actually take the drug on a daily basis? Can they do the stuff they want to do with their friends and family? Those are the things I actually care most in the later line setting. So, you mentioned the options. I think it's a really important choice finding what's that best option for that particular patient you see in front of you every day.
Yeah, and I think this lack of response is something that we have to sit and talk with our patients because imagine that we have the situation that we've been tracking those nodules in the CT for like 2, 3 years, and then overnight we're gonna stop tracking these nodules because you're gonna start with this treatment and those nodules will not shrink anymore. So, the patient might think, well, what the hell I'm doing? What am I supposed to take this if those nodules are not shrinking? So you have to explain, well, you're gonna live longer, but okay, I'm gonna live longer. Those nodules will not shrink, and then I'm gonna, poop, six, seven times per day. I'm gonna have like this nausea, et cetera. So we have to balance. This is all, it has all to be the discussion about, quantity and quality of life. Of course, you know, always, you know, better to have options. So right now we have at least, you know, three options approved, you know, for, you know, later lines, right? So second line, I would say, second line depends basically what you did for the first line. But you know, for third line setting, we have like, you know, a TAS-102, usually with bevacizumab, fruquintinib and regorafenib. They're all approved. We don't have, you know, head-to-head comparison. We're not gonna have, we'll never have like a head-to-head comparison because I think we'll need like 100,000 patients, you know, to see any difference, if we have any difference. But of course, we have like more options in coming and clinical trials opening every day. I guess, what is your practice, Roger? I mean, when you know, usually you refer your patient with metastatic colorectal cancer for a clinical trial, for example.
Yeah, you know, I feel like, so as we mentioned from the beginning, we do our NGS testing. So at that time, I have an idea. You know, at our institution, we have clinical trials specifically for colorectal cancer. We have phase one trials. So it's already on my radar to try to plan it. And I also know our co my colleagues at other institutions, Moffitt, we know the trials you have, as well as another institution nearby. You want to be ready when the time comes. But typically, once a patient progresses on conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy with appropriate biologics, I think once you hit third line, that is a pivotal time period, high risk for clinical deterioration. If a patient's able, I think clinical trial makes a lot of sense before their performance status worsens. Because, yes, I think all of our trials, the majority, have been done in the later line setting, acknowledging that is the most difficult time period for a patient for treatment for colorectal cancer.
I agree. And yeah, I mean, I would say we have like sometimes, you know, clinical trials and, you know, late lines, even like agnostic, you know, for any biomarker. And sometimes, you know, for earlier lines, for example, we have like a trial now for a specific type of, you know, KRAS mutation, KRAS G12D frontline setting. Not easy to recruit those patients because, you know, we're not going to have a lot of referrals from outside, you know, for frontline. And this is a kind of conversation I always, you know, have with my colleagues in research. So we need more and more trials for later lines because usually this is the time that everybody will refer patients, right? So after FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, this is the time that, you know, you might prefer a clinical trial versus, you know, approved therapies. And of course, if, you know, if you don't have a clinical trial available, you're going to start with one of those therapies. And sometimes, you know, and this is usually the way how we work. So if you refer and we don't have a slot right now, you might need to start with one of those, you know, therapies and wait list, you know, these patients. We're gonna have like data from, you know, Stellar, you know, trial coming, you know, ESMO this week with Zanza and atezolizumab immunotherapy. I had a, you know, opportunity to treat a couple of patients and the expanded access with the botensilimab and balstilimab combination. Very potent combination with, you know, this new CTL4, but more toxic, you know, with more colitis compared to like ipi/nivo or you know other, you know, anti-PD-1 and anti-CTL4. So a lot of things, you know, coming to, you know, to this field, like for, you know, later lines, ADCs, BiTEs. So and this is why we have to work together, because part of those you know, those trials like or CAR T or cell therapies, et cetera. Unfortunately, you know, if we ended up seeing a real benefit in this kind of a therapy gets approved, you know, down the road, this patient might need to go to an academic center. So they might need to travel for treatment. So this is not kind of a therapy that they're going to be able to, you know, receive in community setting. But we also have a lot of, you know, clinical trials. Like there is an ongoing trial with, you know, fruquintinib and TAS-102 combined, for example. This is a great trial. Patients will take, you know, tablets at home, you know, doesn't require, you know, IV injections, et cetera. So, yeah. So, but keep in mind that we might have clinical trials even for earlier lines, right? So not only for later, but I agree with you. Most, you know, referrals we get, you know, from.
We actually have that trial as well. I think that makes a lot of sense to see if the combination can. So yeah, it's very interesting how to.
KRAS is for sure the hottest topic in GI oncology now. So I've treated a lot of patients in one of our trials, you know, with pancreas. It works, you know, fantastic for pancreas, and I think this is going to get approved, you know, really soon. But for colorectal, it's a little bit, you know, trickier. You need to combine this with anti-EGFR as, you know, expected. And but you know, speaking about, you know, biomarkers, I feel bad because, you know, if you compare a patient with colorectal cancer with a patient with breast cancer, for example, I feel like there's a lot of more awareness, you know, from patients, you know, about biomarkers for breast cancer. So if you have a patient with breast cancer, she will know if she's, you know, triple negative, if she's, you know, hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive, et cetera. But if you ask your patient with colorectal cancer if it's RAS or BRAF mutant, they don't have any idea what the hell is that. So do you have the same sensation?
I think, I think, you know, GI cancer, not just colorectal, kind of late to the party. Breast cancer has really driven this, like the importance of it. But I think we're doing a better job, right? You know, we always, you know, there's been a change. We know about microsatellite MS status, right? That's so important, especially with the recent data. And I feel like HER2, right? HER2 is emerging as well. So I totally agree. It's not the same thing as breast cancer, but I think there's a change, a positive
Are
change.
you testing all patients for, you know, HER2 with colorectal?
I do. Like, you know, I feel that, another, if you can find a biomarker abnormality, you know, we know that the chances are patients are going to do better if you target that abnormality. So, yeah, I test all patients for it. Correct.
Yeah, I agree. Again, I think for metastatic colorectal cancer, it's all about exposure, right? So if you wanna, sometimes you might, you know, have like a huge response and take this patient to surgery, and of course, or local therapy, and of course, this is going to increase, you know, life expectancy. But otherwise, you know, you're gonna improve, you know, life overall survival, exposing these patients to different therapies, hopefully, you know, without a lot of toxicities. Anti-HER2 therapies in colorectal is a great example. We have many options. Again, not we don't have a head-to-head comparisons. We're not gonna have this probably with, you know, anti-HER2 therapies too, but many options without, you know, chemotoxicity, et cetera. So it's a great biomarker, but again, unfortunately uncommon, so less than 5%. But the only way to find those 5% is, you know, testing everybody, right?
Yeah, and I heard this from someone else. Is if you don't test, you don't know. I really like that.
Exactly,
That resonates
exactly. That
completely in my practice.
Absolutely. Well, I think we can wrap up with this. That was
Got
great,
it.
Rachel. Thank you so much for, you know, for your time. Thanks for joining this conversation. And I really want to have you in the future, you know, to discuss other topics in GI oncology. Okay.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it
Thanks
as
for your
well.
time, man.
Thank you. Bye.